Greetings, listeners. This is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia, with this month's news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club for February 2024. I am Andrew, a VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. Details on when to hear the news and information bulletins are available at the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, along with 2-metre repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you missed the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. Just put RAOTC into your favourite search engine. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email? Our address is raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's news broadcast. Welcome to the February 2024 edition of RAOTC Club News. The countdown to February 19 is on, and the new class license system for amateur radio operators, and I suspect that not an awful lot will change. I personally think it's probably a little bit like the year 2000 millennium bug, where there was fear amongst some that they would fall off the edge of the earth, but in actual fact, virtually nothing changed at all. We've just got a little bit older. Geez, that's almost a quarter of a century ago now. Time certainly does seem to fly. There's plenty of information on the transition to the class license system available on both national and local radio clubs, as well as the ACMA website. One good outcome seems to be that the cost of obtaining a license should drop considerably. If you've renewed your license after December 9, as in my case, you may be able to obtain a partial refund. I received a letter this week from the ACMA outlining how to go about this. Amateurs must renew their license even if they expire on the day before the introduction of the class license. A partial refund of paid license fees will be made by the ACMA. Only valid paid licenses will be moved to the new class license system. That is, if you're a little tardy at paying your bills and accounts on time, your call sign will probably be released for reissue, and you could lose it. I wonder who will be first to try this. On another interesting note, there are a few amateurs who seem to like collecting two-letter call signs, and I'm aware of at least one who has a total of 4 two-letter call signs allocated to them. We'll see how this goes. It should be very interesting. The March 2024 OTN was scheduled to go to the printers in late January. The issue is the result of hard work by the editorial board and the desktop publisher, Tim Robinson, a VK3YBP, who has set up a template and laid up OTN using Scribus. Scribus is free open source software. One minor disadvantage in Scribus does not come with a handbook. To find answers to problems, an internet search is required. We will only be able to produce OTN if we receive articles to publish. Members are requested to write articles. The RAOTC copy editors can polish the articles and do any necessary wordsmithing. Tim, VK3YBP, and Jim, VK3ZKK, are working on a system to enable members to record stories and events on a digital recorder or mobile phone and submit them. Tim and Jim will turn them into written articles. The addition of relevant photos or images will make the articles more interesting. This process will enable members to record stories that other members can provide, especially those who do not have computers and those who think that it is too hard to write an article. Tim and Jim will produce a set of questions that the interviewer can ask to get the ball rolling, and hopefully the amateur being interviewed will open up and provide a lot of interesting information to be crafted into a written article. A letter was received from Leo Nett, Secretary of the Morskodian Fraternity, Beechworth, and was received via our fellow committee member, Peter, VK8ZZ. The The Morse-Code telegram system, reintroduced by the Morse-Codian fraternity in the 1980s, is in decline. Across Australia today, Beechworth, Victoria is the last operating telegraph station remaining and needs volunteer operators there. And to keep a telegraph service alive in other potential locations in Melbourne and central Victoria. For further information, and if you think you might be able to help, please contact Leonette on 0435 584 857. Once again, the phone number is 0435 584 857. Bequests and legacies. Following on from the club news I presented in December, entitled Planning Ahead, is an article in the January and February edition of Amateur Radio Magazine. In recent months, the board of the WIA has been contacted by a number of our members in relation to bequests and legacies. Information is available from the WIA president, Scott Williams, VK3KJ, or the WIA secretary, Peter Klee, VK8ZZ, whose contact details are available on the WIA website. New members and silent keys. I haven't been advised of any new members or silent keys in the last 2 months. Members are reminded the very latest club news is available via the ROTC website. Put ROTC into your favourite search engine to find it. www.rotc.org.au. The next broadcast I'll present is due to take place on Monday, the 1st of April 2024. However, next month there will be another historical broadcast from years past presented by Alan Dable, VK3AMD. And that's about all the club news we have for you at this time.
You are listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club Australia Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
OTN available on audio DVD. A little-known service that the RAOTC provides for vision-impaired members is an audio file on DVD of each edition of OTN shortly after each issue is published. As soon as each issue of OTN appears, Ian Godsill, VK3JS, reads onto audio file the complete magazine from cover to cover. This is a mammoth task, and Ian is to be congratulated for the countless hours he spends recording each issue of OTN. These audio DVDs are then provided free of charge to the small number of vision-impaired RAOTC members. If you are vision-impaired to the extent that you are unable to visually read OTN magazine and would like to be put on the mailing list for these OTN audio DVDs, please contact the RAOTC at raotc@raotc.org.au or via Post Office Box 107, Mentone, Victoria 3194, or by telephone direct.
This month we have a couple of technical articles for you. First up is Clive, VK6CSW, who will discuss Making the Connection, a short history of the London Underground Railway map, how it was developed, and how the map is now used throughout the world. This article first appeared in OTN several years ago. This will be followed by the second part of a discussion of the history of the transistor and its early development. Now, it's over to you, Clive.
Making the Connection, a Subterranean Circuit. Even though you may never have been to London, just about everyone is aware of the general style of the London Underground System map, a style copied by almost all of the world's underground railways and a good many surface public transport systems too. This is the story of how that style of map came about. Prior to January 1933, the London Tube map had always been geographically based, But as the system expanded and extended further out into the suburbs, trying to maintain an accurate geographic representation of all the different lines that together made up the London Underground system meant that the close spacing of stations in central London made it increasingly difficult to squeeze in all the names, making the map confusing and quite hard to read. In 1931, a junior draftsman named Henry Charles Beck had a brilliant idea. Harry, as he was known, had worked in the Signal Engineers Department of London Transport for some 6 years and felt that the geographical tube map was less than satisfactory. The brilliant aspect of his idea was the realization that conventional maps can be too accurate and therefore unnecessarily complex and crowded. Instead of trying to portray the real distance between stations and the correct angles at which the various tube lines actually intersected, Beck's map simply provided a schematic display, rather like the electrical circuit diagrams his daily work involved. His map suggested that virtually every station was equidistant and that the lines only met or changed direction at neat 45-degree or 90-degree angles. From the traveller's perspective, this geographical inaccuracy was, and still is, of no consequence. A person simply wants to know how to get to a particular destination, which lines to travel on, and where interchange stations are. When Beck first presented his map to the London Transport Publicity Committee in 1931, it was rejected, but, following some improvements, including the use of bright, contrasting colours for different lines, it was accepted the next year. In January 1933, 750,000 copies of the new schematic map were distributed free to Londoners and proved an instant success. From London Transport's point of view, they had picked a real winner. Since its inception, the design has brought in millions of pounds in licence fees from all sorts of organisations worldwide, and not just underground railways, but bus lines and even general businesses. History records that Harry Beck's reward for his idea was either 5 or 10 guineas. The figure is uncertain, but in view of its success and the revenue generated for his employer, I guess you could say that Harry was well and truly short-circuited. This article was freely adapted from The Subterranean Railway, a book by Christian Wolmar, published by Atlantic Books in London, 2012.
Thanks very much, Clive. OTN on disk. Are you aware that the entire collection of OTN is available on disk, delivered right to your door for the minimal cost of $25? The files are all in a portable document format or PDF and can be viewed on any tablet or desktop PC. As time moves on, you've probably noticed that over the years you tend to hoard a few things. When something new arrives home, you have to find room to keep it. Well, why not consider adding the entire collection of OTN? The really good news is, it won't take up any space at all, and it won't provide any food for the silverfish, if you're plagued by them. There is another advantage that might not be quite so evident. The files are pretty much the same as what goes off to the printer twice a year. As time moves on, many readers realise their eyes aren't as young as they used to be. Viewing articles on a 22-inch screen is a whole lot easier. You can zoom right in and have one whole column on the screen at a time. Like online newspapers, it's not quite the same as a printed copy. But the advantage is you don't have to worry about where you're going to keep the things. Further details of how to order OTN on disk is available from the RAOTC website, www.raotc.org.au. This is Andrew, VK3CAH.
You are listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia, Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
The history of the transistor and its early developments. Rattan started working on building such a device, and tantalizing hints of amplification continued to appear as the team worked on the problem. Sometimes the system would work, but then stop working unexpectedly. In one instance, a non-working system started working when placed in water. The electrons in any one piece of the crystal would migrate about due to nearby charges. Electrons in the emitters, or the holes in the collectors, would cluster at the surface of the crystal, where they could find their opposite charge floating around in the air or water. Yet they could be pushed away from the surface with the application of a small amount of charge from any other location on the crystal. Instead of needing a large supply of injected electrons, a very small number in the right place on the crystal would accomplish the same thing. Their understanding solved the problem of needing a very small control area to some degree. Instead of needing two separate semiconductors connected by a common, but tiny, region, a single larger surface would serve. The emitter and collector leads would both be placed very close together on the top, with the control lead placed on the base of the crystal. When current was applied to the base lead, the electrons or holes would be pushed out, across the block of semiconductor, and collect on the far surface. As long as the emitter and collector were very close together, this should allow enough electrons or holes between them to allow conduction to start. An early witness of the phenomenon was Ralph Bray, a young graduate student. He joined the germanium effort at Purdue University in November 1943 and was given the tricky task of measuring the spreading resistance at the metal semiconductor contact. Bray found a great many anomalies, such as internal high resistivity barriers in some samples of germanium. The most curious phenomenon was the exceptionally low resistance observed when voltage pulses were applied. This effect remained a mystery because nobody realized, until 1948, that Bray had observed minority carrier injection, the effect that was identified by William Sharkey at Bell Labs and made the transistor a reality. Bray wrote the following: "That was the one aspect that we missed, but even had we understood the idea of minority carrier injection, we would have said, oh, this explains our effects. We might not necessarily have gone ahead and said, let's start making transistors, open up a factory and sell them." At that time, the important device was the high back voltage rectifier. Sharkey's research team initially attempted to build a field effect transistor, or FET, by trying to modulate the conductivity of a semiconductor, but was unsuccessful, mainly due to problems with the surface states, the dangling bond, and the germanium and copper compound materials. In the course of trying to understand the mysterious reasons behind their failure to build a working FET, this led them to instead inventing the bipolar point contact and junction transistors. The first working transistor. The Bell team made many attempts to build such a system with various tools but generally failed. Setups where the contacts were close enough were invariably as fragile as the original cat's whisker detectors had been and would work briefly, if at all. Eventually, they had a practical breakthrough. A piece of gold foil was glued to the edge of a triangular plastic wedge, and then the foil was sliced with a razor at the tip of the triangle. The result was two very closely spaced contacts of gold. When the plastic was pushed down onto the surface of a crystal and voltage applied to the other side, on the base of the crystal, current started to flow from one contact to the other as the base voltage pushed the electrons away from the base towards the other side near the contacts. The point contact transistor had been invented. Rattan and H. R. Moore made a demonstration to several of their colleagues and managers at Bell Labs on the afternoon of the 23rd of December 1947, often given as the birth date of the transistor. The PNP point contact germanium transistor operated as a speech amplifier with a power gain of 18 in that trial. In 1956, John Bardeen, Walter Hauser Rattan, and William Bradford Sharkey were honored with the Nobel Prize in Physics for their researches on semiconductors and their discovery of the transistor effect. 12 people are mentioned as directly involved in the invention of the transistor in the Bell Laboratory. At the same time, some European scientists were led by the idea of solid-state amplifiers. The German physicist Herbert F. Matari had conducted experiments at Telefunken with what he called the duodiode, that is double diode, from 1942, when he first observed transconductance effects with silicon diodes manufactured for German radar equipment for World War II. Finally, on the 13th of August 1948, Matari and Heinrich Welker, working at Compagnie des Frères at Seniors Westinghouse in Aulnay-sous-Bois, France, applied for a patent on an amplifier based on the minority carrier injection process, which they called the transistrin. The device was shown publicly on the 18th of May 1949. Transistrins were commercially manufactured for the French telephone company and military, and in 1953 a solid-state radio receiver with four transistrins was demonstrated at the Dusseldorf Radio Fair. As Bell Labs did not make a public announcement of their transistor before June 1948, the transistrin was an independent parallel discovery and development. Bell Labs needed a generic name for the new invention: semiconductor triode, surface states triode, crystal triode, cell triode, and iatatrin were all considered, but transistor, coined by John R. Pierce, was the clear winner of an internal ballot, owing in part to the affinity that Bell engineers had developed for the suffix "ister". The rationale for the name is described in the following extract from the company's technical memorandum calling for votes. Transistor. This is an abbreviated combination of the words transconductance, or transfer, and varistor. The device logically belongs in the varistor family and has the transconductance or transfer impedance of a device having gain, so that this combination is descriptive. Pierce recalled the naming somewhat differently. He said the following: "The way I provided the name was to think of what the device did. And at that time, it was supposed to be the jewel of the vacuum tube. The vacuum tube had transconductance, so the transistor would have transresistance. And the name should fit in with the names of other devices, such as varistor and thermistor. And I suggested the name transistor." The Nobel Foundation states that the term is a combination of the words transfer and resistor. Early conflict. Shockley was upset about the device being credited to Brétain and Bardeen, who he felt had built it behind his back to take the glory. Matters became worse when Bell Labs lawyers found that some of Shockley's own writings on the transistor were close enough to those of an earlier 1925 patent by Julius Edgar Lilienfeld that they thought it best that his name be left off the patent application. This article, "The History of the Transistor and Its Early Developments", is based on information from Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia.
You are listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
Perf Luncheons. The popular and well-attended monthly luncheons for RATC members and friends in and around the Perth area are held on the second Tuesday of each month. The VK6 RATC group have a new venue, the Woodbridge Hotel, east of Guildford. Reports indicate the hospitality to be excellent. The Perth group meet at 11:30 a.m. for lunch at 12 midday. This is not a buffet meal, but excellent food in both pensioner and standard portions are available. We would like to place orders at 12 midday, so please don't be late. This information is courtesy of Phil, VK6ZKO, whose contact details can be found on the club's website. It's customary to end this broadcast with a humorous or short story, and this one's entitled Catching Salmon. Paddy and Predrag are walking down the road when they see a guy pushing a bike. On the back of the bike is a beautiful salmon. "How did you catch that?" asks Paddy. The man with the bike explains that a mate of his hangs him over a bridge, and when the salmon comes along he scoops it up. Paddy and Predrag thought that this was just too easy to miss out on, the opportunity to catch a beautiful salmon. So they both go down to the nearest bridge, and Paddy lowers Padraig over the bridge and waits. 10 minutes goes by. "Any sign of a salmon yet?" Paddy shouts down. "Nothing yet," shouts Padraig. An hour passes, and the same. No salmon in sight. Suddenly Padraig shouts, "Paddy, Paddy, pull me up quick! Have you caught a salmon there then?" Padraig replies, "No, be quick, there's a flummin' train coming!" Wrong sort of bridge, I suppose.
That's all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies, and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. If you have missed all or part of this broadcast, or you just want to listen to it again, it is available for download from the RAOTC website. Simply go to www.raotc.org.au. Again, the website URL is www.raotc.org.au. On the right-hand side is the main menu. Click on VK3OTN Broadcasts, and you will be able to see the various times and frequencies of the VK3OTN transmissions by all of our volunteers, provided of course a volunteer is available. Down towards the bottom of the page is the current and previous 5 broadcasts for you to listen to. Sometimes the relay station is an automated broadcast, for example, a repeater, where no operator is available to take callbacks. Other times the volunteer operator suffers from very heavy local QIM, and callbacks are not always possible. Many operators need a small amount of time to switch from playing a recorded file to using a microphone. Please be mindful of this. This is VK3OTN signing clear from today's news and information session. 73 from the RAOTC broadcast team.